Welcome, everybody. This is the sixth lecture of Money, Monopoly, and Market Intervention, the Mises Academy class, where we're going through the third section of Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. So for tonight's lecture, we're focusing on the first third of Chapter 12. So that's the last chapter of the book. We're in the home stretch here, the last chapter, which deals with all forms of intervention into the free market economy. So here we see an outline of what we're going to cover tonight, lots of material. As always with this stuff, I'm going to focus my remarks tonight on where I think the most value can be added, in the sense that I'm not going to just, there's lots of material in here, and some of it I think is pretty standard stuff, so I'm not going to go over that too carefully. I'm just going to focus on things that maybe you guys wouldn't understand the context, or just to make sure if it's a particularly subtle point. Big picture, let me just make sure you guys are getting this. So the first 11 chapters of Man, Economy, and State, basically the whole book, Rothbard is spinning out the implications of praxeology in the context of a free market economy. So in the context of, so what he's doing is he's looking at and saying, given the People Act, what can we logically deduce about their actions, or you know, what true statements and observations can we make about their actions and how they're all interrelated if we assume from the outset, or rather if we just restrict our analysis to situations in which people obey property rights. And it's only in chapter 12 where he's now going to relax that and start looking at situations where people do not respect property rights. And let's be clear here, Rothbard says that this is still part of praxeology. It's not the most well-developed area of praxeology, but his point is it's not that praxeology was the first 11 chapters, or even that economics was the first 11 chapters, and now in chapter 12 we're doing something outside praxeology or even outside economics. He says, no, what we're doing in chapter 12 still is within both. Because, you know, when you define what economics is, it's the science, the study of exchanges, or I don't remember the exact terminology Rothbard used, catalactics for sure involved, using, you know, when there's exchanges involving money. I mean, that's, you can still talk about those things in the context of somebody violating property rights. You can still talk about a careful, logical deduction and reaching conclusions that are apodictically true given the initial assumptions that concern human action, even concern exchanges involving a universally accepted medium of exchange, but in which people are violating property rights. Okay, so the reason I'm just belaboring this is I just want to make sure you understand the framework here, that this is still part of economics and more, you know, obviously part of praxeology, since economics is a subset of praxeology. So the point of doing chapters 1 through 11, the study of the free market, is to understand how that system works, so then when you contrast it with intervention, you have some idea of how to proceed. And Mises talks about that a lot too, saying you can't really analyze interventionism or even socialism unless you understand how a market economy would work. And that it's, well, I don't want to get too much into this, but the point is not, of course, that the results you have for the market are only valid if in the real world there is a perfectly free market. Obviously, that's not the case. If it were, then there'd be no point in studying it, because we know right now there's not a free market. But the point of doing it is, how could you know whether you wanted a free market or not? You know, when you're trying to determine what kind of policies do we want, what kind of world do we want to live in, it would be weird to say, like, we're not even allowed to consider what it would look like in a totally free market, because, oh, we don't have that right now. And that's part of the point is, well, do we want to have that, and how would we know unless we can imagine and think through the logical consequences of what would it be like to live in a totally free market economy. Okay, so that's what Rothbard's trying to do in this chapter, is to do a praxeological analysis of, or even more narrowly, an economic analysis of intervention. He, in the next thing, you know, power and market, Rothbard tries to do an even broader approach and to do a praxeological analysis of aggression, basically, which is broader than what he's doing here. I could be wrong here, so don't quote me on this. I'm pretty sure when Rothbard originally wrote this all out, he wrote the first 11 chapters of what we now consider Man, Economy, and State, and then wrote what we now consider to be Power and Market, and the publisher was just like, that's way too long. And so I think Rothbard condensed what we now call Power and Market into Chapter 12 of Man, Economy, and State, and then published Man, you know, the book that we now know of as Man, Economy, and State was actually like a condensed version. I think that that's that basic story I just told is at least somewhat related to the truth of what actually happened. Okay, so first slide here, state versus private intervention. I just want to be clear. The term intervention normally we use to mean something the government does. Like, even Rothbard, I'm sure if you were just caught him in casual conversation and said, hey, these guys put ski masks on and robbed a bank last week, I doubt Rothbard would say, oh, really? I hadn't read about such an intervention in the newspapers. Right? You know, he would call it a robbery or a holdup or, you know, theft, but I don't think he would call private criminal doing something an intervention, because that term, we usually use it to refer to the state doing something. So I think Rothbard, just to be complete here, you know, he mentions in the beginning of Chapter 12 that intervention, you know, what I'm doing in this chapter would apply to any type of intervention or aggression against property, but in the context that economists normally discuss this stuff, and because empirically it's the most relevant, we're going to just basically focus on the government doing these things. But in principle, if you had a, you know, an organized criminal boss who was going around trying to enforce minimum wage laws, the results would be similar, you know, just depending on the level of enforcement. I mean, that's really the – well, there's two things. One difference is between the government or the state and typical private criminals is that the private criminals just want your money, or they want, you know, like if the Godfather needs you to do something for him, you know, like you, if you work at a bank or something and he wants you to leave the door unlocked, you know, they might put pressure on you to do that one thing, but then they're going to leave you alone. Or, you know, if they're just a recurring band of robbers or something, I mean, they might come back and pillage your village every once in a while, but they're not going to tell you how to educate your kid. It wouldn't even occur to them to do that. And so, I mean, there's a famous discussion, and I don't remember who said it, but like the difference between the state and the highway robber. And it's, you know, something like, at least the highway robber, you know, as he's taking your money at gunpoint, doesn't, you know, has the decency to not then lecture you on how you should live your life and to try to make it look like he's doing you a favor and you should be thankful that he's taking your money. At least, you know, he has the common decency that when he's robbing you at gunpoint, just to be frank about it and say, give me your money, and then you give him the money and he leaves you alone, as opposed to the state, which, you know, robs you far more than anybody else probably does during your life, and then on top of that tells you what substances you can put into your body, you know, how you can teach your kids, whether you can practice a certain religion, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, there's that aspect of it that, in practice, the state engages in all manner of interventions, whereas private criminals typically don't. And then beyond that, just empirically, if you're trying to discuss the impact of violations of property rights, by far, hands down, the biggest violator is the state. I mean, that's just an institutional aggressor against property rights, the way Rothbard conceives of property rights. So that's why we're focusing on the state in this chapter. Okay, he gives a what he calls a typology of intervention, and the word typology there just means a classification scheme. or you, in biology, you might call it taxonomy. You know, just so you just want to have a classification framework so that any kind of intervention you can think of, you can put it into one of these three boxes. That's all he's doing here, in case that seems a little bit weird to you. And the point is, because Rothbard, again, he wants to be very systematic about this. He doesn't want to just do a haphazard, you know, looking at taxes and then looking at drug laws and then looking at rent control and looking at the draft. He wants to have a whole framework within which he could discuss anything. And then, of course, he's going to hit those popular items that economists typically discuss that I just went through. But the point is, he wants to have a framework that's complete. And so we know this is complete just because he's exhausted all the possibilities. So maybe somebody down the road would come up with a framework that would be more convenient, but the point is, this is a comprehensive classification scheme of all types of conceivable interventions, because he's saying one involves the government or whatever the intervening agency is. So for the rest of this lecture, I'm going to not keep bringing up that caveat. I'm just going to say the government or the state, but you know, in principle, it could refer to the local kingpin crime leader if for some reason he started caring about, you know, whether the people in his neighborhood smoked pot or something. So there's, first of all, the autistic intervention, in which, so here, I mean, don't be confused, every intervention is going to involve at least two people, the intervener and the object of the intervention, or the, you know, the victim, if you will. So the autistic intervention doesn't mean somebody isolated, it means what the intervener is doing is just sort of isolating what the person can do in his or her own affairs. So if the government comes in and says, you know, you're not allowed to practice a certain religion or else we'll punish you, or you're not allowed to read this book, and you got to be careful there, that we're not talking about you can't buy the book from somebody, because that would be a triangular intervention. But they're saying you can't, if we ever catch anybody reading this particular book, then you cut your hand off or something. You know, so that would be an autistic intervention, where what the government is doing is really just saying what sorts of things you can do in your own private life that don't actually directly involve anybody else. And then a binary intervention is one in which the intervener is using coercion to alter the relationship between the subject and the intervener. So the classic examples here would be taxation. And then triangular intervention is where the intervener is coming in and interfering, you know, with coercive means, relationships between two people. So that, you know, these two people otherwise would have done something amongst themselves, and then the intervener comes in and alters the nature of that relationship. So that is a comprehensive classification. And notice too that, like, the triangular one actually is pretty broad, because you can think of all kinds of real complex things where, you in other words, you might say, well, what if the government says you're not allowed to use a megaphone to stir up a crowd to go riot? Isn't that broader than a triangular? Like, isn't that a, you know, hexagonal or something, depending on how big the crowd is, because it's discussing the relationships among many different people? But the way Rothbard would handle that is, well, no, but it's, you can look at it as catching, you know, the guy with the megaphone and each individual listener in the crowd. And so that it's like a series of triangular interventions. Like, that's the way Rothbard would capture something like that. Okay, Rothbard has some remarks here on utility analysis. So let me first explain where he's coming from and what he means, just to make sure you get his point, and then I'll bring up some possible difficulties with it, some objections people have brought up. So first of all, he wants to say there is a sense in which, if you want to use this kind of language, the free market maximizes social utility or the utility of everybody in society. And he, even here, you can tell Rothbard, like, you're almost dragging it out of him because he's putting maximizing in quotation marks and social welfare in quotation marks. And then he'll say, you know, to the extent that you want to, you know, but we don't want to think of it as a cardinal term. You know, so he's, what's going on there is he wants to try to, how can I put it? He's very skeptical of the whole branch of economics, of mainstream economics, called welfare analysis. And there, that doesn't mean welfare like food stamps welfare. Welfare meaning the well-being of society. So in mainstream economics, you can have just standard equilibrium price analysis where you're not, as an economist, you're not making any, you're not passing any judgment on the social desirability of various outcomes. You're just saying matter-of-factly, oh, this is what happens in this situation. You know, the firms maximize profit, consumers maximize utility. If we have competitive markets, this is what happens. If we have monopolistic markets, this is what happens, blah, blah, blah. And but then you have welfare analysis, where you have the economist trying to say what institutional structures are in some sense better or worse from a social point of view. And so there, if you're advising the government, then that's where welfare analysis comes into play. So they still think they're being very objective because they have probably the most famous principle is what's called the Pareto criterion. You probably heard these terms, some of you, or like for something to be Pareto optimal, what does that mean? It means it's an outcome in which there's no feasible rearrangement of resources or use of resources or distribution of the final output. There's no feasible rearrangement of that would make every single person better off according to his or her own utility function or preference relation if you don't want to be cardinal about it. And so it's not so much that the mainstream economist is going to say any particular Pareto optimal outcome is good, because in general there's a whole infinity of Pareto optimal outcomes, and so how do you just pick one of them and say that's the best one? But what they can say with some confidence and justification is that a Pareto suboptimal outcome is bad, because by definition, if an outcome is Pareto suboptimal, and that term, it comes from the economist Pareto, that's where that funny word is, it's a guy's last name. If an outcome is Pareto suboptimal or Pareto inferior, then by definition, that means there exists a feasible rearrangement of society's resources such that every single person in society would prefer that second outcome to the first one. So the idea is if there's a way we could move to a different state of the world in which unanimously we all agree that second state is better than the first one, and this is according to our own preferences. So, I mean, that could include your religious views. You know what I mean? So it's not just saying you get more tacos or something and so you get more in your belly. I mean, it can be, you can define what goes into your utility function very broadly if you want to. And they're just saying if it so happens that we could rearrange how we do things such that every single person in all the earth thinks the second outcome is better, well, then clearly that first outcome is bad. Why the heck would we want to be in that first outcome if there's a feasible change that makes everybody better off? So that type of analysis falls under the umbrella of what's called welfare analysis. And Rothbard has a famous essay called Towards a Reconstruction of, I think, Utility and Welfare Analysis. But if you Google it and say Rothbard Towards a Reconstruction, you'll hit it. I forget the exact title. It's got welfare and utility in the title. So what I'm talking about here is, so in general, Rothbard is very dubious. Or not, he's dubious. He thinks that stuff is very dubious. He's very skeptical of it because it is dubious. And there's all kinds of issues there. Like, they think they're being neutral, but they're smuggling in ethical assumptions. A lot of them, in practice, start aggregating what should be subjective individual preferences to come up with a social welfare function and stuff like that. So Rothbard, and incidentally, I mean, if you're taking graduate level economics, you should at some point read that essay, because there Rothbard really rolls his sleeves up and gets mathematical and goes through and starts critiquing some of the what at the time when he wrote the essay were cutting edge developments in mainstream neoclassical utility theory, stuff like the von Neumann Morgenstern utility functions and how do mainstream economists deal with uncertainty and stuff like that. So it's just to give you a little, go off on a tiny little tangent here. I read that that essay before I had gone to grad school. So when I was an undergraduate, I read that Rothbard's Towards a Reconstruction of Welfare and Utility Analysis, or whatever the exact title is. And I thought it was pretty good, but I didn't understand some of it. And then I went to grad school to NYU, and I learned all that stuff. You know, that, like, I could do proofs and things regarding, let's take preference relations, and I'll come up with a von Neumann-Morgenstern utility function, and I'll prove Arrow's theorem about, you know, you can't have a social welfare function that has all these properties, blah, blah, blah. I mean, at NYU, that was actually what their specialty was. You know, it's called a theory, but like microeconomics and game theory and all that kind of stuff, and really the nuts and bolts of cutting edge utility theory. That was one of the things NYU was really good at, and that's just what I went into because at least it was rigorous. Whereas the, you know, econometrics didn't even make sense to me. Like, I didn't even know what they were doing. I didn't even get the rules they were using in that class. And the macro, I kind of got what they were doing, but it was so crazy I couldn't stand it. Whereas the micro game theory stuff, they were making some heroic assumptions, but at least it was rigorous. Like, okay, you give me those assumptions, fine. These are the results, fair enough. So that's what I went into. So my point is, after I went through that and I really knew that stuff from a mainstream point of view, I went back and reread Rothbard's essay on the Toward a Reconstruction. I was just blown away by really how well he knew the stuff. I mean, so we're not just bluffing as Austrians when we say Rothbard understood the math and he rejected it. You know, because of course a common complaint against Austrians is, oh, you guys just, you're not good at math. And so that's why you go into Austrian economics, because you can't handle the math. And that may be true for some of the people who are attracted to the school now, but certainly that's not true of Mises or Rothbard. I mean, they knew Rothbard especially understood the math. So anyway, that was a long tangent. Coming back to our point tonight here, the slide, what I'm saying is Rothbard is very hesitant to even talk like this because I think he knows there's lots of red flags and minefields. But what he's trying to say is, look, if you want to say anything about an arrangement that makes everybody better off or, you know, maximizes social welfare, the only thing you can plausibly say is that the free market does it, because every act of voluntary exchange, at least ex ante, makes both people better off. In practice, it might make one or more worse off because you could make a mistake. You might think something's going to be good from your own point of view, and then afterward you regret having done it, and you know, you might slap your head and say, oh, shoot, I wish I hadn't done that. But if an exchange is voluntary, then by definition it means you wanted to do it because you thought it was going to make you better off. So his point is, since the free market is the collection, if you will, of all voluntary exchanges, or the web of such things, and moreover, since it has all the right incentives that can be humanly imagined to allow people to seize and exploit all those potential gains from trade, that almost by definition is the epitome of an institution that maximizes social happiness. Because whereas, in contrast, under intervention, from the get-go, by construction, by its very definition, when the government intervenes, it is making at least one person worse off, because it's using coercion. So by definition, the outcome that is induced because of the intervention is not making the one person, at least one person, better off, because otherwise, if the person would agree to it, then you wouldn't need to use the threat of force. So Rothbard is saying, given the fact that you cannot, I don't think he says this in this chapter 12 section, he does say it in Power and Market, I'm almost positive. Or, sorry, he does say it in the Reconstruction essay. I think he says it in Power and Market. I don't remember. But he makes the pretty subtle point that even on its own terms, then, using mainstream welfare analysis, you know, with Pareto optimality and all that kind of stuff, all the bells and whistles of these mainstream economists, you could make a prima facie case that a competitive equilibrium in the free market is Pareto optimal, whereas any intervention clearly is Pareto suboptimal, because at least one person is harmed by it. So on their own methodological strictures, they should not be supporters of intervention. Or to put it another way, it cannot possibly be the case that any government intervention leads to a Pareto improvement, because clearly it's harming at least one person, namely the person that the force is being deployed against. So that's the that's where he's coming from. That's what he's trying to establish here. So there have been some objections, and yeah, people are asking in the comments. Yeah, so this is all ex ante. The market, in a sense, maximizes utility ex ante because, again, everybody engaging in voluntary exchanges expects to benefit ex ante. In practice, ex post, they might be wrong, but ex ante, they think they're right. Whereas the government intervening, it's a very strong argument. It's even ex ante, it makes somebody worse off. So we're not just saying in practice, the interventionist might not end up helping. You know, maybe they're trying to help the poor, but they end up screwing things up, and so in practice it's bad. That's not even what we're saying here. We're saying no matter what, by its very nature, government intervention cannot possibly constitute a Pareto improvement, cannot even hope to make everybody better off, because there's always at least one person that's getting the shaft, so to speak, and who doesn't agree with it, because if the person did, then you wouldn't need the government to do it. If it was something that everybody agreed with, then you wouldn't need the government. It would just be voluntary. So let me just spend a minute or two on, there are, people have raised objections to this argument. It's not so much, I think he's on pretty solid ground with the second part of it, that it would be hard to try to say with a straight face that the government is going to use force to make people better off. The one, like, the tricky aspect of it where somebody might make a case is to say something like, if we have a situation where it's like a prisoner's dilemma, or like there's a public good. So the kind of thing where like let's say there's a situation where, oh, if everybody in the society kicked in $10, we could build a missile defense system that protects us from incoming nuclear missiles. But there's a free rider problem, and if you had a free market, nobody would contribute, because, like, if enough people contributed so this firm built the thing, then everybody's safe from the incoming missile, so nobody else would contribute. And so, you know, you could tell a story where, oh, the market can't provide it, but if the government just came in and forced everyone to kick in $10, we would all receive whatever, you know, millions of dollars worth of benefits because of we're now protected from a nuclear attack. And so that's the kind of argument that somebody might use on this second part of Rothbard's argument to try to show the weird sense in which you could benefit by being forced to do something because, or if everybody else is being forced at the same time. All right, and this actually comes up with this issue of, if you've been following this in the blogosphere lately, people have been talking about progressive taxation, and is it hypocritical when Warren Buffett says, oh, I want the government to raise my taxes? And so you say, well, nothing's stopping you from writing a check to the IRS for more, so go ahead. If you're such a great guy and you want to pay more to the Treasury, go ahead and write him a check. Nobody's stopping you. And then, you know, the comeback is, well, no, really what I mean is I want to live in a country where the rich all contribute more than my individual. So anyway, you get into those types of things. But so You, I mean, you understand the arguments. I'm just pointing that out, that that's one type of objection a person who's not an anarchist would make, that type of response to Rothbard's second point. The first point, though, even other anarchists, anarcho-capitalists, and even an Austrian economist have had issues. So Brian Kaplan, who doesn't call himself an Austrian anymore, but I think is still considering himself an anarcho-capitalist, he has a problem with this first one. And I know some other people too have, and even I think in grad school might have written something here where here it's not. I'm not so sure this works, because it seems like what Rothbard's trying to do is to have two different things. So on the one hand, I guess what I'm trying to say is, it looks like what he's trying to do is to say, using just purely neutral, value-free economic analysis, we can draw conclusions about something, but he ends up having to sneak in like part of his value system. And so what I mean, for example, is he gets into this in chapter 12 when he's talking about this, that he, if you've read the footnotes, you see he presented this, and then Ludwig Lachmann and some other people at this seminar objected to this argument. And they said, well, what about criminals? That whether it's the government doing it or even a private defense agency, in a free market, what if some guy tries to go rob a bank, and then the private defense agency or the government comes and with guns and shoots at him and they leave? Well, clearly that action that is consistent with the free market and upholding the market and the defense of property rights made that robber worse off. Like, you can't say according to that robber's own value scale he benefited from that. And so, what does it mean when you say this the market economy maximizes social utility? And then Rothbard, he basically says, well, I'm not including the criminals, and that's why it maximizes the welfare of all society. And so, there, I mean, you get what he's saying, and okay, but then from a certain point of view, he just clearly contradicted himself. He's basically saying, I'm not including criminals as part of society, which is fine, but then it's, so anyway, my point is, it looks like he's trying to say, I'm not bringing in my ethical views about the legitimacy of property rights, and I'm just neutrally, independently saying a system in which we all obey property rights makes everyone as best off as could possibly be. And then when you say, but what about the people who are harmed by such a system? You say, well, they don't count because they were trying to break the rules of the system. So yeah, it makes sense if you believe in the legitimacy of those property rights, but if you had a different system, like when statists say, what are you talking about? This is all voluntary. If you don't pay your taxes, then you go to jail because you're not playing by the rules. So everybody's, we're maximizing the welfare of everybody who plays by the state's rules. And of course, yeah, if you're some guy who doesn't pay his taxes, you're mad that you go to jail, but that's because you didn't pay your taxes. You're a criminal. Right? So if somebody argued like that, and you as an anarcho-capitalist, you'd say, what are you talking about? So again, by the same token here, if you already agree with Rothbard about the legitimacy of the property rights and where they come from and everything, then yeah, in a sense, allowing people to freely exchange those property rights is the best system. But if you didn't already think that, this would not be an independent reason to support the system. I guess that's what I'm getting at. Okay, price controls. I'm not going to spend too much time on this because this is straightforward stuff. I have a little note here. If you want to see me spell this out more carefully and elaborate it and cross all the T's and dot all the I's, my book, Lessons for the Young Economist, which is, the PDF is online for free. Just Google my name and that book title and you'll get it. So let me just walk you through some of this stuff really quickly, just in case you've never heard this before formally. So price controls just mean they're a class of interventions. They are a triangular intervention because there the government is interfering with what two people in the market are trying to do with each other. Namely, they're trying to buy and sell something, and the government's coming in and saying, oh, if you guys trade with each other in this way, we're going to punish one or both of you with force. So a maximum price control, or what's called a price ceiling, meaning that the government puts a ceiling so that you can't go up any higher. That's what the deal with the ceiling is. That's the metaphor. Is this left diagram here. So there, of course, the government says if we catch anybody trading above this ceiling price, this maximum price, then we'll fine you, or we'll throw you in jail, or we'll cut your head off, whatever. And so the way you typically do these economic analyses is first you just say, assume, well, for one thing is, for it to have much relevance, if it's a maximum price control, it's got to be below what the market clearing price would be. So in this diagram here on the left, if that horizontal line were up here, if it were above this market clearing price, then at least in terms of this simple diagram, there would be no effect. Now, actually in the real world, even if you did have a price control that wasn't binding, you know, so if the government came in and said, you're not allowed to sell milk for more than $100 a gallon, you might think that would have no effect, but actually Robert points out it would, just if for no other reason than there needs to be some government officials in that bureau, and so they're getting their income from taxation. So just having that extra government agency there is burdening the taxpayer. And also beyond that, too, that just might change people's expectations about the future, right? So if the government came in right now and said, Mises Academy's lectures, it is now a crime if you charge more than $500 for a course, for an 8-week course, technically that wouldn't affect us because we have no plans of raising prices. But, I mean, it might make us nervous about, well, gee, should we keep pouring resources into developing this, because how do we know? Maybe they're going to lower that price down the road, or if price inflation really kicks in so that everything, you know, goes up by a factor of 10, well, then maybe we would have wanted to raise the price above 500, a few, you know, that kind of stuff. But the standard analysis, textbook analysis, you say, okay, it only really matters if it's lower than the equilibrium price. And then, so what happens? And the other thing, too, is normally at this first pass of it, just to do the basics when you first teach this stuff, you assume that everybody complies with it. So you assume the government is enforcing this with such severity that you're not just causing a black market where people go around it and they actually trade at a higher price. You just assume, what if everyone actually obeyed this thing? What would happen? So what is the defining attribute of the market clearing price where this demand curve and supply curve intersect, this point P? That price P, the market clearing price, is the one at which the quantity, supply, and demand are equal. So if this price C, which is below that, you're necessarily going to have a shortage because the quantity supplied is here at A and the quantity demanded is at B, and so this gap between the two is the shortage. And so that is the quintessential, you know, first order effect of a price ceiling, is that it causes shortages. So the obvious example people always use is rent control. That in big cities, the government might come in and say, oh, we want to keep housing affordable, so for certain apartments of this many square foot, and blah, 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 you can't charge more than, whatever, $600 a month, when the market clearing price might have been $850. And so then all of a sudden now there's a shortage of apartments, and if you're trying to move, you just can't find an apartment. It's a real pain. And you have to wait months, you have to get on lists, you have to do all kinds of tricks, you have to know somebody to find an apartment. And so that all comes back to the fact that just the simple supply and demand analysis, again, once you understand what does it mean for it to be a market clearing price, namely the one that equates quantity supplied and demanded, well then if the price isn't allowed to be that high, so long as you think supply curves are upward sloping and demand curves are downward sloping, then that means you're creating a shortage. Another historical example of this would be the gas lines of the 1970s. That there, you know, as I'm sure many of you know, in the United States, there was a period where there were long lines at the gas pump, and the government had all sorts of rationing schemes, like depending on your license plate, what day of the week you could go and buy gas and stuff like that. And a lot of people thought, oh, that was because the Arab countries weren't sending us much oil. You know, they had the oil embargo. But no, it wasn't. It was because the Nixon administration had price controls. That's it, the Arab oil embargo would have raised the market clearing price because that restricted supply, but the market still would have worked. You wouldn't have had lines at the pump. You just would have had to pay. What would have happened is the market price of gasoline would have been so high that at that high price, the people who wanted to buy gasoline would have been reduced until the point at which the available supply was sufficient to satisfy all the quantity demanded. Because that's what the market price does. It rationed the available supply to the people who want to demand it. Okay, like I said, there's a lot more to say about this stuff, but this is pretty basic price analysis, so I don't want to take time when we're going through Rothbard to go through it. If you want to see me spell out the standard analysis of price controls, and then even do some non-standard stuff, but I think in a very accessible way, or I hope, I encourage you to look at the relevant section in my book, Lessons for the Economist. Okay, but let's just do the obvious stuff for a minimum price, so or what's called a price floor, for the obvious reason that it's saying you can't go below this, just like you can't go through the floor, you can't go down below this, where you set the price up above what the market clearing price would be. So here what happens is you cause a surplus. And the classic example of a minimum price would be minimum wage laws. So here the government's saying, if we catch any employer paying a worker less than whatever, $6.85 an hour or whatever it is nowadays, we will fine you a lot of money. And so if you, for the purpose of the analysis, you assume all the employers comply with that, what happens? Well, at the higher mark, at the higher price, you're above the market clearing wage. So that means at this higher price, because demand curves are downward sloping and supply curves are upward sloping, it has to be the case now that the quantity demanded of labor by the employers is less than the quantity supplied. And so you have this gap here of where you've got workers who would love to sell labor hours at the prevailing wage rate, and yet they can't find an employer who wants to buy their labor. So if the government removed the minimum wage, what would happen is the prevailing wage rate would fall back down to this point. And at that market wage, what would happen is some of the workers would fall out of the market, and at the lower wage, employers would demand more total hours. And then those two things would be equilibrated, and so there would be no involuntary unemployment. So there would still be, even at the market clearing wage with no minimum wage law, it's not that it would be utopia. I mean, there might still be people sitting at home watching Jerry Springer, and their wife comes home and says, hey, why don't you go get a job? And the guy's, no, there's nothing good out there. But the point is, he could go get a job tomorrow if he wanted to. It's just, it doesn't pay much, and he thinks, oh, I'm worth more than that. All right. Whereas with genuine involuntary unemployment, when there's minimum wage laws, there might be somebody who, his buddy is making whatever, $7 at McDonald's working the cash register, and this guy is just as qualified as his buddy. You could talk to the manager at McDonald's and say, if this guy who has the job right now suddenly quit, would you be willing to hire this other guy? And he'd say, yeah, sure, that guy's qualified. He could work the cash register. I'd pay him $7 an hour. And the guy who can't get the job, you ask him, oh, are you too good for that job? He says, no, I would work there in a heartbeat. My wife keeps yelling at me to get a job. Yeah, I'd work there for $7 an hour. And so then, but yet, he's not getting hired. And there, it's because the government is keeping the wage rate up. And so the manager says, well, I've only, it's $7 an hour. I've only got one position. I can't hire two people. I can't carry two people on my payroll at $7 an hour with those skills, because it just doesn't make sense. I'd be losing money. But I could carry one of them, and I don't care which one it is, because this guy right here has the job, so I'm not going to fire him just to hire the other guy. So you see the difference there, that with the minimum wage, where there's a surplus of labor, what that means is there are potential workers who would be happy to work at the prevailing wage and who, from the employer's point of view, are interchangeable with the people who do have the jobs, and yet they can't find anyone to hire them. That's what it means when there's involuntary unemployment, as opposed to somebody who's just being real picky and actually could go get a job but says, no, I'm holding out for something better. That's the distinction. The other thing, too, is let me just – this isn't a point that I see economists stress often enough. I added a little caveat in there, and they have to be interchangeable from the employer's point of view. A lot of times economists don't mention that, and they just say, oh, there's unemployment, there's a glut of labor, or there's surplus labor, or you have involuntary unemployment, if the workers would be happy to work at the prevailing wage rate, but they can't get someone to hire them, and they say, oh, that's unemployment. No, it's not, because, like, for example, I could look at the salaries for the people who play for the Celtics, you know, the professional basketball team. And I could say, I would be happy to be a starting guard making whatever they're making, you know, $300,000 a year. I'd love to do that. And so I go the next time they have tryouts and I apply for the job and I say, yeah, I'd like to be a guard for the Celtics and make $300,000 a year. That's actually less than probably what you're paying your guys. So I'm ready to work for the prevailing wage. Give me a job, and they don't hire me. Am I involuntarily unemployed? Is there a surplus there in the market for point guards for the Boston Celtics? No, because the employer does not view me as interchangeable with the guys they already have on the payroll. Okay, so just be careful when you do that analysis. That's a crucial part that a lot of times we don't mention, but that's obviously part of it. So when we say somebody is involuntarily unemployed, we mean he or she would love to work at the prevailing wage rate, and the employer would view that person as interchangeable with the people right now who are working. All right, Rothbard talks about Gresham's Law, and he makes a good point, so let me make sure you follow this. So first of all, there's a lot of stuff in economics that every economist, if you grabbed them and said, what is this, they would tell you. But then the actual historians of economic thought or the people whose work touches on that area know that that's sloppy at best and wrong at worst. So one example would be Say's Law. If you grabbed any economist and said, hey, what's Say's Law, they're going to say, oh, supply creates its own demand, which on the face of it is just wrong. What the heck does that even mean? And then, so you know, for those of you who took my course on Keynes, you know that, okay, if you go read Jean-Baptiste Say and you see his law of markets discussion, it's very nuanced, and you okay. And so what we now summarize as Say's Law is actually a very thoughtful discussion, and there's certainly a sense in which it's entirely true. But most economists haven't read that, and they just always heard, oh, Say's Law is supply creates its own demand, and that's stupid. So by the same token, then, everybody knows that Gresham's Law is, quote, bad money drives out good. But then, as Rothbard says, you know, on the face of it, that doesn't make any sense. Or what's worse is it makes it sound like the market fails when it comes to money. Because what if you're changing for a minute? What if we said, oh, there's Murphy's Law? Well, that confused you, Murphy's Law. There's Thornton's Law, the economist Mark Thornton, and he discovered that in the marketplace, bad tuna drives out good. So that if you try to go to the store and buy tuna fish, you're only going to get cans of rotten tuna fish that will make you sick, because there's this tendency in the market for bad tuna to drive out good tuna. Or, you know, bad cars drive out good cars. And actually, that is what the market for lemons model shows, right? So that Robert's point here is, if this were true literally, if that were the end of the story, that there's just this law of economics that bad money drives out good money, that would be pretty bad if you were a proponent of the free market. And so Robert says, no, this isn't true. If you had a genuine free market in money, then bad money wouldn't drive out good. Good money would drive out bad. That firms that were mints, you know, private mints that would take gold and silver and stamp them into coins and come up with logos and various like putting notches around the circumference to make sure that somebody couldn't clip the coin and to make it hard to counterfeit and all that kind of stuff, they would drive out the bad producers, right? And so at any given time in a free society where the money was produced voluntarily in the marketplace, the money those people used would be gorgeous, right? It'd be works of art. And I'm not just making this up. I mean, George Selgin has a cool lecture he gave at the Mises Institute where he went through that and looked at, you know, the period when there was relative freedom in minting, that, you know, the coins that were actually produced were actually very beautiful. And, you know, they were, and of course, they were hard to counterfeit and so forth. So it's not true that bad money drives out good in a free market. Now, what Gresham's Law means, and Gresham's Law is true if you understand the context and where it comes from, and it was a very cogent observation. What it really means is that when the government enforces price controls and artificially undervalues one money and overvalues another money, then people will hoard the undervalued money and they will spend the overvalued money. So when you're looking out at the world, at the marketplace, you will only see people buying and selling in terms of the money that's overvalued, and nobody is going to buy and sell with the, well, they would sell because they want to get the undervalued money, but nobody's going to pay with the undervalued money. They're only going to pay with the overvalued money. And so that when they say bad money drives out good, that's what they're talking about. So the context of this historically is what's called bimetallism. And that was where, so remember, traditionally, you often had that gold and silver would emerge as the market's money or monies. And so if you think through the logic of what makes something a useful medium of exchange, gold and silver satisfied all those properties. You know, they're durable, easily divisible, homogeneous units, you know, as opposed to diamonds or emeralds where, you know, you could get two different emeralds and they'd be hard to compare to each other. Where you get 2 ounces of gold, they're pretty similar if it's just the raw gold and if, you know, if it hadn't been formed into an intricate coin or something. So gold and silver, and also the other criterion would be that they have a convenient weight or a convenient market value per weight, per unit weight. So that's why gold and silver were pretty good money, whereas bronze or tin or aluminum or something like that would not be, because that's too, you would need too much of it to handle everyday purchases, whereas, you know, plutonium or something might be too valuable. Like, you know, you would just need too little of it besides the, I think it's probably radioactive or something. Okay, so for all the reasons that gold is a really good medium of exchange, well, so is silver. And in many places, they would both be money simultaneously, where for larger purchases, people would use gold, and for smaller purchases, they would use silver. Or maybe they would use, like, you know, gold bars or something, and then use silver for the coins, like for the change, whatever. So that's what happened. And so various governments, and Mises talks a lot about this in the theory of money and credit, they, at least according to Mises, if I'm remembering this properly, he thinks at one point the governments actually thought they were helping. Like this wasn't some sinister plot, but maybe Mises is being naive. I'm sure Rothbard would. I'm sure if you asked Rothbard, he would come up with some reason that somebody was getting rich off of it and screwing everybody else. But Mises was saying they thought what they were doing there was ensuring both money or both gold and silver. Like they, in other words, they wanted gold and silver to both circulate as money, and so they thought they were helping people and keeping things straight. And so they would say, for example, they'd pass a law saying, okay, something that has a certain price in terms of gold, well, you know, whatever, however many gold ounces it costs, you can also buy that with 16 times as many silver ounces. So they would lock in the ratio of 16 to 1 for the value of gold to silver. And vice versa, if some merchant's selling something for, you know, in terms of silver, and, you know, he's charging 1,600 ounces of silver for something when you could come along with 100 ounces of gold and buy the same thing. Like, he would legally have to sell it to you for that. All right, so that's what bimetallism was. So the government thought, and you can understand where they were coming from, that they thought they were just establishing, you know, like a rule, like the way that you might say how many feet are in a yard, thinking you're just establishing standard weights and measures. The government might say, oh, to help commerce, to clarify contracts and stuff like that, if somebody quotes something in yards, well, that means 3 feet per yard. And, you know, but if somebody quotes something in shillings, well, how many pounds does that mean? You know, that kind of stuff. So they thought, okay, a given number of ounces of gold is the same thing legally as 16 times as many ounces of silver. So they just thought they were making it convenient for people to use gold or silver, and so that would be neutral and keep both metals circulating as money. But of course, so what Gresham's law was saying is, no, all you're doing there is you're going to have an alternating standard. You're not actually going to have both gold and silver being used as money at the same time. It's going to ricochet back and forth. That when, according to the market, gold is actually worth more than 16 ounces of silver, then everybody's going to buy stuff with silver. And they're not going to spend gold, because now, you know, gold is actually being undervalued. And so if you happen to be sitting on gold, you're not going to spend with it. You're going to buy something with silver, right? Because you want to buy something out there, it's got a price, whatever it is. And you could buy it with gold, which you actually believe is really 17 times as valuable as the silver. And when I say valuable, I don't mean subjectively. You know what I mean? Like the market valuation of it. And so you're gaining the thing at a premium if you can buy it with only 16 silver ounces. So everybody's going to be buying stuff with silver in that world, and nobody's going to spend the gold. And then vice versa, if things change, you know, more gold is mined or whatever, for whatever reason, if now all of a sudden gold is fewer than 16 ounces to silver, then it's going to flip. Now everyone's going to hoard silver and just spend with gold. So there, it's also misleading too about the bad money drives out good. Now I think where Gresham's law actually came from, so Mises was applying it to bimetallism there, but I think actually where Gresham's law originated and why they call it bad money drives out good, because you might say, well, what are you saying? The silver's not bad or the gold's not bad. What does that mean? Well, if you have a thing where people are buying and selling with certain coins, like coins that have Caesar's face on them, and then Caesar comes along, takes the coins, and then melts them down, and then puts in some base metal, and then remints them, and has 10% more coins. And then he goes out in the community and tries to spend them, and the merchants, of course, start distinguishing and saying, whoa, you know, if this thing right here will cost you 10 gold coins if it's the original coin that was circulating last year, but if it's these newfangled coins that we all know have been debased because they have, you know, copper in them or whatever, then you got to pay me 11 of those new coins. So Caesar doesn't like that, because that defeats the whole point of him debasing the currency, and so he passes a law saying, as a merchant, you are not allowed to distinguish between the types of coins. You have to accept coins at face value. If the coin says on it, this is 1 ounce of gold or whatever the unit they used, you have to pretend that it really is an ounce of gold, even if you know it's not. You're not allowed to distinguish between the genuine 1 ounce gold coins and the ones that we just poured a bunch of bronze into. So if that law is now being enforced, what of course the merchants do is they raise their prices 10% because no one's paying with the real gold coins. They're just paying with the debased gold coins, because if you're going to go buy something, you're going to get rid of coins, and they trade it at par. You know, if you're not allowed to get more from the shopkeeper with the genuine gold coin than you are with the debased one, well, then you'd be an idiot to spend with the genuine one. You spend with the debased one. So the merchants know that, so they just all raise their prices, and then all you see in commerce, in circulation, as it were, is the debased gold coins. So the bad money drove out the good money. Now nobody ever comes across a genuine gold coin, except, you know, people have stockpiled, you know, they buried them in their backyard or something, but nobody trades with those things anymore. So that's what Gresham's law, I think, historically came from, that phrase, bad money drives out good. But just, again, notice what's going on there. It's not that there's some failure of the market. It has to do with, it's a form of price control. In case, I'm sure everybody kind of gets that and you understood what I just said, but there's a real easy way for you to picture it in your modern life. So if you're in the United States, you know that, or maybe you don't know, but you should know that before like 1962, coins actually had silver content. So like a US quarter from 1950 actually has some genuine silver in it. So it's worth more than 25 cents. The silver content of a US quarter that was made in 1950 right now has more silver, it has silver in it that has a much higher market value than 25 cents. But if you go to the store and try to buy something with it, they will just, you know, chances are the cashier isn't going to give you a premium on it. They're just going to say that 25 cents. Certainly if you go to a coin-operated machine trying to get a soda, you're not going to put in a quarter that's from 1950 unless you're making a mistake and you didn't realize what you have. So there you see Gresham's law in operation, that nobody, unless they're making a mistake, buys with U.S. coins that are before 1962. They will, they'll hoard that, right? And so people only spend the coins that have been totally debased by the U.S. government. Because again, in most places, you're not going to get more for that than now. In some places, you can. I don't think it's illegal for someone to sell. How can I put it? I don't think it's illegal for someone to say, "We will honor." You know, if you pay with silver content coins, we'll give you a discount or something. I mean, I don't actually know the relevant. I wouldn't do it and advertise it because probably you would get the feds coming down on you for something just because they don't like that kind of stuff. But I don't know if it's actually technically illegal. But the point is, that'd be kind of a hassle. Like if you just go to the grocery store and try to pay with coins from 1940 and say to the guy, the cashier, "Oh, look at all the silver I'm giving you. The cash register says I owe $100, but let me just pay you with $20 worth of quarters according to face value." That's going to be a pain. They're going to have to call the manager over, and they're going to think you're trying to scam them. So the point is, nobody is going to nobody's going to spend with those things. So that's an example of Gresham's law that maybe is easier for you to grasp the concept, and you can see. So the point is, let's say you get change at the grocery store, and you're walking out to your car, and you're looking through the coins, and one of them you realize is from 1945. You're going to say, "Oh, it's my lucky day." And you're going to go home and save that. You're going to go put it in your safe deposit box or whatever. You're not going to then go spend that because, you know, so that's the idea. That's an example of Gresham's law. Okay, Rothbard talks about resurrecting monopoly price. And he says that, and I don't have much to say here, he just points out that we went through in – what was that, chapter 10 or 11? I'm getting mixed up now. I think it was chapter 10. He goes through monopoly price, and he said, "We buried it, but now we're going to raise it from the dead or resurrect it." I forget how he described it, meaning that, that back there, what we were saying is, remember, the way that mainstream economics discusses the alleged welfare problems of market monopoly was completely spurious because there was no such thing as a so-called monopolistic price to be contrasted with the competitive price. Rothbard was just saying there's just the market price and there is no such thing, that you're just inventing this artificial concept. And so it doesn't even make sense to say, oh, this is what the market price is right now under monopoly. Wouldn't it be better for consumers, or actually for everybody, like on net, wouldn't the benefits to consumers outweigh the harms to producers if we went from this arrangement to a competitive outcome? That's actually the correct way that a mainstream economist would talk. And Rothbard's saying, well, there is no competitive, I mean, that's like saying, wouldn't it be great if we had the technology from Star Trek and we could just start making meals just by talking to a computer and it appears? Yeah, but who cares? That's not the world we live in. That, you know, this is the market, this is the supply and the demand curve, and what are you talking about to contrast that outcome with the alleged competitive price? Well, Rothbard says it does make sense to look at a market where the government is intervening and the government sets up a privileged position for one group or, you know, one collection of firms and says they are the only ones who are allowed to be the producers in this area, and if we catch anybody else doing it, then we're going to punish them. And Robert says, so it does make sense to look at what the, if you will, equilibrium price and output are in that setting, and then to contrast them with the market price and output. And so he said, actually, a lot of the mainstream welfare analysis of the problems of monopoly does apply to government monopolistic privileges. All right. Then Rothbard gets into binary interventions, and specifically he's talking about taxing. And he says that there's some confusion that some writers, some even people who are in the tradition of free market economics, they argue about, you know, what's the proper measure of government interference with the economy? Is it to say how much is the government taxing, or is it to say how much is the government spending? So Milton Friedman, and I don't know if Robert had Friedman in mind here, and actually, now that I bring it up, I don't even know if Friedman wrote this before Rothbard had written this section of the book. So, you know, maybe the thing I'm thinking of came afterward. But I think Milton Friedman once said something along the lines of, you know, who cares about taxation? The real thing with the government is how much it spends. And so, and what Friedman was getting at is, rather than us tinkering with the tax code and trying to come up with, you know, ways to either raise more revenue or to constrain revenue, or worrying about the size of the deficit, we should focus our efforts on controlling government spending and getting that to be smaller, because if we can do that, then everything else is a piece of cake. That the reason the government's trying to tax us so much is because they're spending so much, and that if we can just get the public to stop demanding so many government services and get the government to lower spending, then we'd be fine. And that also, when the government spends, no matter how it got that revenue, whether it came from taxation or borrowing or printing money, the government is gaining control over real resources. And so Rothbard's not saying that that viewpoint is wrong, but he is saying it's a little bit too glib, that on the other hand, if the government's taxing, that's also taking money away from people. And so the people are losing command over resources. So in practice, what Rothbard says is just whatever one's bigger is what the government's doing. So if the government is spending and running a deficit, so that, you know, the government spends $2 trillion and it only raises $1.5 trillion in taxation and it borrows the other $500 billion, well, then the government is messing with $2 trillion worth of resources, because, you know, that's what it's spending, and it's ultimately redirecting those things. You know, if the government's buying tanks, it doesn't matter where the money came from, the steel and the computers and whatever else that go into making the tank are now physically not available for the use in the private sector. So the government has increased the scarcity, if you will, of what's available in the private sector. So there's that aspect to it, and that's the kind of thing that Friedman had in mind. But on the other hand, Crawford says, even though this is much rarer empirically, if the government raises $2 trillion in taxation and only spends $1.5 trillion, well, people still had to fork over $2 trillion, and they're definitely worse off. And, you know, it's not like that somehow disappears just because the government might not have spent it. Whatever it does with the money, whether it retires the debt, you know, if it runs a surplus, or even if it takes that $500 billion and burns it, it's going to distort the economy because those people had to fork it over. I kind of wish, this is my little editorial comment, I think Rothbard was a little bit too glib there, and I would have preferred if he just finished that train of thought, because I'm not sure what he thinks. Let me just put it to you this way. Suppose the government does tax people and then burn some of the money. Isn't there a sense in which that's a lot better than if the government spent that money? Right? So the government, let's say there's two different scenarios. Scenario number one, the government taxes $2 trillion and it spends $2 trillion. And I think Rothbard agrees that in that scenario, the government, in a sense, does $2 trillion worth of damage or distortion, whatever you want to call it. But in scenario two, suppose the government taxes $2 trillion, it spends $1.5 trillion and it burns $500 billion. So there, what happens is prices in general are lower than they would have been in scenario one because the quantity of money has been reduced. And the government has commandeered fewer real resources. And so one way of seeing what happened there is the private sector, their cash balances now go farther because prices have fallen. And so, it's not that it's literally equivalent, but it's kind of like if the government taxed $2 trillion and then took $500 billion of it and refunded it to everybody and then spent the remaining $1.5 trillion, surely that would be better than if it just spent the whole $2 trillion. And so, like I say, not that it's a wash. If the government taxes $1 trillion and then burns it, that still messes everything up, and it's discoordinating, don't get me wrong. But I would have thought if Rothbard had to choose between the government actually spending money and getting people to do stuff and to give up resources versus just burning it, that he would far prefer the government to burn some of its tax revenue. Whereas if you read this discussion in this part of the book, it sounds like he's saying, no, once they tax it, they did that distortion, and even if they burn the money, so they already did the damage. Okay, let me just warn you, Rothbard here, he's at his finest in one sense, but he also might confuse or mislead the right word, but just be careful here, okay? Because what he's doing is great work in sort of bucking conventional wisdom, and he's being iconoclastic, right? So this is, you know, what Rothbard does is he's looking at something with fresh eyes and just sort of questioning whether the emperor has clothes and saying, well, just because all the economists normally analyze it this way, well, let's think about that from scratch. And actually, no, that doesn't make any sense, right? So this stuff is all great, but I just want to let's just be careful and make sure you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. That, I guess that's what I'm saying, that you might go too far with some of these trains of thought. So, first of all, he says, look, there's no such thing as a neutral tax. So here he's reacting to mainstream tax theory. There is this, what they're trying to do, he's saying, is impossible. They're trying to come up with, because what they do is they go through each actual tax, and they point out all the ways that it distorts the market, and that's all correct. But he said there's this idea, like they're searching for, oh, we're just trying to find the tax where the government could obtain its needed revenue to spend on all of its important programs, but without distorting the market. And Rothbard's just saying, look, that's impossible. Just admit that. You know, don't even delude yourself. He said, at the very least, you can always divide society up into the net taxpayers and the net tax consumers. And he said that, you know, some people fool themselves, they'll say, oh, well, no, even the government employees are paying taxes. Like, you know, even the fireman who gets money from the city and the guy who works for the IRS gets a paycheck, but he has to pay taxes too, just like everybody else. But Roberts, that's silly. If the government employee's official paycheck is $50,000 and he pays $10,000 in taxes, he's not really paying taxes. Really, what's just happening there is on net, his payment from the government is $40,000. And so we should just view that as he is a parasite on the rest of society extracting $40,000 a year, not to look at it like, oh, his pre-tax income is $50,000 and he pays his taxes just like everybody else. That's not right. The only reason that guy gets anything is because there's taxation. So clearly that guy is not impacted by taxation to the same degree that everybody else is. So for that reason alone, the fact that you can always divide society into people who are net taxpayers and net tax recipients, Rothbard saying there's no such thing as a neutral tax, a tax that would allow the government to fund its activities without distorting what otherwise would have been the market outcome. Rothbard saying that, you know, just even state it, when you state it in those ball terms, you realize it's impossible. Okay, Rothbard talks about a head tax versus a flat tax. So here, again, these are very interesting, and Rothbard almost, you know, goes out of his way to be, I don't want to say avant-garde, but shocking. You know, he says stuff that would make most people guffaw, but, you know, just because he's coming at it from an anarchist point of view, he's saying just about everybody loves a flat tax, or at least economists, I should say. So let me just spend a minute or two on why do economists talk like that. And actually, well, let me just send you guys this before I forget. So it just so happened in today's Forbes, Forbes.com, there is an article. So for those of you who are hearing this later and if you want to just Google it, it's by John Tamney, T-A-M-N-Y, and the title of the article is "A Flat Tax Would Be Fine, comma, A Consumption Tax, True Perfection." And so this is at Forbes.com. So a lot of what Tamney says is unobjectionable, but as the title suggests, this is exactly the kind of thing that Rothbard can't stand, and that's what he's attacking in this section of the book. That this guy Tamney is a right winger, a free market kind of guy. You know, he's actually published a lot of my stuff at Forbes.com. You know, I write op-eds and things on the free market, and this guy publishes a lot of my stuff. The reason I came across his article is he published my article today on something else. So what I'm just saying is this Tamney thing epitomizes the mindset that Rothbard's trying to attack. So anyway, the typical right-wing lover of the free market approach to why flat taxes are good, and just personal disclosure, I've written a policy proposal for the California state government to switch to a flat tax, so that's why I know this, because I've done this stuff too, and Rothbard probably would have a heart attack if he saw my thing. Where they're coming from is they're saying, look, right now, what you don't want to have is high marginal tax rates. You don't want to be penalizing people. You especially don't want to have progressive or graduated tax codes where the more money you make, the higher percentage you pay on your income. Right? And so that's the system that most industrial economies have right now. The income tax code is designed so it has multiple brackets, and the rate goes up the higher the income level. So for various reasons, that's a crazy system. That it's penalizing the most productive people in society from working. And so the idea is if you switch to a flat tax where you just figured out, okay, instead of having multiple brackets at ascending rates, what if we scrap the whole system, started from scratch, got rid of deductions and exemptions and tax credits and all these loopholes and everything, and just said, okay, flat out, everybody, you just write down what your income is on a postcard and you multiply it by this one percentage, and then that's what you owe. End of story. You know, you don't get to deduct your mortgage, the interest on your mortgage payment. You don't get to lop off $1,000 for every kid you have. If you make charitable contributions, you don't get to deduct that. If you have health expenditures, so what? Just write down your income, multiply it by a percentage. I don't care if you're a billionaire or if you make $1,000, you all pay the same percentage. And then how much do you owe the government? And so then they say, if we did that, what percentage would we have to use to maintain revenue neutrality? So in other words, if everybody behaved the same and we scrapped the current income tax code with all its multiple brackets and levels and deductions and loopholes and all this other stuff and just replaced it with this real simple thing where it's one percentage, what would that number have to be so that if everyone behaved the same, the government would be taking the same total amount of revenue? So that's what a lot of people have in mind by flat tax reform. And the reason they like it is obviously that number is going to be pretty low. It's going to be a lot lower than the current top rate, you know, the top bracket. Because first of all, the tax base is bigger because you're getting rid of all the loopholes so that, you know, there's more stuff to be hit with that percentage. And, you know, just arithmetically, if before you were taxing a portion of it at a real high rate and a lot of it at a lower rate, if you're just going to say replace it all with one rate, that's going to be in between what used to be the top and the bottom rates. All right, so clearly the marginal rate is going to be lower, at least, you know, for the high income earners. So the idea is, oh, they're going to have the incentive now to go out and work a lot more. If you're, you know, running a business, you're going to do a lot more sales and just expand your operations because now you're getting to keep more of your profits. All right, so that's the logic behind it, and it's true as far as it goes, but Rothbard has a lot of several critiques of that. So one thing he's saying is, first of all, that you're raising taxes on poor people. And so, you know, if you're a libertarian who thinks taxation is theft, then it's, you know, whatever else you might say about that tax reform plan, you're raising taxes on poor people. So how can you support that? You're saying I'm going to perhaps reduce the amount of theft from on one group, but I'm going to increase it on somewhere else. So that's kind of hard to justify. Another thing is he hates the whole idea of this revenue neutrality, which is typically what you do in these tax structure analyses, is you just take it as, you know, a given. And the reason they do that is they're trying to compare apples to apples, right? So you're going to say, okay, given what the current system takes in right now in revenue, if you were going to switch to a flat tax, what would the number have to be to keep bringing the same amount? So it doesn't technically, you could be for a flat tax and want to have lower taxes, but anyway, but Rothbard's saying typically in these discussions, they just take it for granted that the government has the right to that much money. And so you know, that's an issue. So he likes the head tax, even though that would probably strike most people as barbaric, where everybody, no matter what, pays the same dollar amount. And the ultimate reason, I didn't see this passage in here, maybe I just missed it, but I've seen elsewhere for sure, where the reason Rothbard likes the head tax is he says, look, given that you're going to have a head tax is great because it can't be very high. By definition, it can only be as high as the poorest person in society can afford to pay, and so that's going to limit how much the government can take from everybody. Another thing he brings up is he says the proponents of a flat tax, they think one of its virtues is that it's proportional. So they understand that it's crazy. You know, why should a rich person who makes $1 million a year, why should he pay 35% of his income to the IRS, or technically, you know, the income above the tax bracket, whereas a person who makes $10,000 a year doesn't pay 35%, pays a lower percentage. That Rothbard's saying the proponents of a flat tax rightly understand that that's kind of weird, but he says where they go wrong is they think it's perfectly normal that everyone should pay the same percentage to the government. And he said that this is weird coming from alleged supporters of the free market, because imagine if you did that with bread and you said, oh, you know, a loaf of bread costs $1 if you're poor, but if you're rich, then it costs $10. He said if every good were priced in this way, then that would be almost socialism or Marxism, and nobody would have an incentive to work. If the prices of the stuff you want to buy scaled to be proportional to your income, then there'd be no benefit in being a millionaire as opposed to being someone who just earns $1,000 a year. And so Rothbard's saying, you know, far from being consistent with free market principles, a flat tax is like the antithesis of them. Okay, we're running low on time here, so let me move on. This part, this last bullet point here is what I meant before, and I said just be careful with how you use this. This tax shifting argument. All right, so Rothbard says quite correctly that a lot of times when people talk about the effect of taxes, like a new tax being levied, that they just say casually, oh, well, you know, all businesses don't pay taxes. They would just shift it on their consumers. In one sense, you would think that would warm Rothbard's heart that people are realizing that, you know, when the government and the politicians claim they're going to soak it to businesses, that you want to be a careful economist and realize, oh, no, that's going to hurt consumers too, and not just think it's going to be contained and limited to the greedy businessman that the average voter might think is, you know, getting hit. But Rothbard, you know, he's being a good economist here. He's saying, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. If it really were the case, let's say the government comes in and says, okay, from now on, if you try to sell liquor, let's say cigarettes, let's say there's no taxes on cigarettes and the market clearing price is $3 a pack. Now the government comes in and says, we're going to slap on a $2 per pack surtax on cigarettes because, you know, smoking is bad for you and plus we need money to pay for schools. So that's what we're going to do. So a lot of people might say initially, thinking they're being very sophisticated, oh, the cigarette companies aren't going to pay that. They're just going to raise prices. And it's the smokers who are going to end up paying that. And Rothbard's point is, well, you can't just say that automatically. You need to go through the steps, because if the cigarette companies could just automatically raise prices $2 a pack, they would have done that already. You know, if the supply and demand curves were such that they could just raise prices $2 a pack, then they would have done that already. If that were the profit, if that brought in more revenue. So now what I'm saying is just be careful here. Rothbard is not saying that a surtax on cigarettes or whatever isn't going to impact consumers. It is going to. But his point is, it's not just because the business can automatically pass it forward. The mechanism that happens is the following. So the government comes in and says, okay, there's a $2 surtax on cigarettes. So right away, instantaneously, the retailer can't just take all the $3 per pack stickers and put on $5 per pack. Because again, if they could do that, they would have done it yesterday. They don't need the government to prod them into making more money. If it, you know what I'm saying? See what I'm saying? And so if you ask, well, wait a minute, why didn't they do it yesterday? The answer would be, well, because the consumer's demand curve is such that if they tried charging $5 per pack, the quantity demanded would have fallen so much that the retailers would have made less total revenue, and so that's why they didn't do it. And so the same thing here. The consumers don't care about the tax. All they care about is how much am I paying out of pocket and how much do I enjoy smoking. So if it didn't make sense yesterday, if you weren't going to get the consumers to cough up more yesterday, then you're not going to today. So originally what happens is they still have to charge $3, but two of which now goes to the government. And so now the retailers are only making $1 per pack, whereas before they were making $3 per pack. So what are they going to do? Well, all the marginal retailers, the people who were, you know, just barely willing to carry cigarettes, now are going to stop. You know, so certain gas stations that didn't have many smokers that stopped in there and had maybe just a little section devoted to cigarettes, they're just going to stop carrying them altogether because it's not worth it now. And that's going to happen. Or, you know, other places that maybe used to do a huge volume, now they're going to cut back or whatever. So now the quantity demanded of, or sorry, the demand curve for cartons of cigarettes by the retailers is going to shift left. And so it's going to keep moving up the chain. So now you know, the cigarette companies are also going to see their business drop off. And so they're going to now buy fewer things. And so ultimately the tobacco farmers are going to see the price of tobacco fall. And so what are they going to do the next time they go to plant? They're not going to plant as much tobacco. Then they're going to plant more corn or whatever. I don't know. The land that is used for tobacco, they're going to take the land that is least suitable for tobacco, but that yet was under cultivation for tobacco, they're going to plant something else there. Whatever, you know, the most lucrative thing is, given that it's not tobacco anymore for that particular plot, those particular plots of land. So in the new equilibrium, what happens when everything adjusts, you have less tobacco being grown, fewer cigarettes being produced. So at any given time, now there are, you know, in any given day or week or month, fewer packs of cigarettes are being sold to consumers at a higher price. So before they were $3 a pack, and now they're going to be more than $3 a pack. So naively, you might just look at the before and after and say, oh, yeah, see, those businesses just passed it along to the consumer. But let's say what ends up happening is before it was $3 a pack, and it ends up being $4.50 a pack. So naively, you could just say, oh, yeah, the business passed $1.50 forward to the consumer, and the business is taking a hit of 50 cents a pack. And so, you know, 75% of that $2 surcharge is being borne by the customer. And that is correct insofar as it goes. And Rothbard, I don't think, is really challenging that per se. And this is what's called, this whole area of economic thought is called tax incidence. That's what the name of this branch of analysis is called. Rothbard's not really challenging that, but his point is the way people normally talk about that is very sloppy, because they make it sound like the business just boom, says, oh, okay, raise prices is $1.50. When they don't have the power to do that, because if they did, they just would have done it already, right? So anyway, I'm just saying be careful there. You might have thought that Rothbard was saying the consumers aren't impacted at all if their demand curves don't change, and that's not what he's saying. Because specifically, you might say, well, wait a minute, how could the new equilibrium price be $1.50 higher if the demand curve hasn't changed? Well, because the supply curve has changed. The supply curve of cigarettes has shifted to the left, and so now the intersection with the original demand curve is at a higher market price. So it's true, the consumers, their preferences for smoking and their demand for money hasn't changed, but the reason on the margin now they're paying a higher price per pack of cigarettes is they're buying fewer packs. And so, you know, the smaller quantity now, the new equilibrium market clearing price is higher. So that's what's going on there. At the higher price, they are buying fewer packs. And, you know, you could say, well, why didn't the businesses do that before? Well, because before the businesses preferred to charge a lower price and have a higher quantity, but now that's not possible. And so now in the new equilibrium, the profit maximizing thing for the business is to sell a lower quantity at $4.50 per pack, knowing that the government's got to get its what did I say, $2 per pack in taxes. Okay, I'm a little bit over time here, and I have to pick up my son, so let me just go through this really quickly. Again, similar things here, my comments on Rothbard with the income versus consumption tax stuff. This is brilliant stuff. He is tweaking the standard analysis and showing what's wrong with it, but just be careful if you might walk away thinking Rothbard is saying something that he's not saying. So let me just go through this really quickly here. So for one thing is, what a lot of free market economists, just like they're for a flat tax, their big thing, and that's why I sent you that Forbes article, is what they really like, beyond taking the income tax and making it flat, is they want to get rid of an income tax and have a consumption tax. And they think that makes a lot of sense. And they'll say things like, oh, because it doesn't penalize work and in saving and investment, it just taxes consumption. So people save more, the economy grows faster, blah, blah, blah. So Rothbard doesn't like that kind of talk, because he says there's nothing, you know, the whole point of saving and investing is so you consume in the future. So it's a little bit weird that alleged free market economists who presumably believe in, you know, the sovereignty of the consumer, that they want the government to sort of penalize consumption and this, and to give a prod to savings and investment. That doesn't make any sense. There's no reason you should do that. You should just let people, according to their own time preferences, save or consume as they want. Now, having said that, though, it is true that the income tax does bias the economy away from the level of savings that people's underlying time preferences normally would have led to. Okay, so let me just say that a different way. With an income tax in place, it is true that people end up saving a lower fraction of their income, typically, unless you make some, you know, tell some really weird story, that an income tax will cause people, it will bias them to consume more in the present than they normally would have, than they would have in a free market. So it is true that an income tax places an extra burden on saving compared to present consumption. And the reason is, when you get, if there's an income tax, let's say there's a 10% income tax, you get your paycheck, let's say it's $100,000, boom, the government takes $10,000 of it right off the top, so now you're left with $90,000. If you consume it now, there's no further taxation going on, at least to you. But if you want to save it and invest and then end up consuming down the road, you're getting hit with the income tax again on the interest or the dividends or, you know, whatever vehicle you're using to save and invest. The gain you're getting, so you know you have $90,000 now, and you could go buy a bond with it that would grow to $100,000 next year. Well, you're going to get hit again with the, you know, that $10,000 in interest income is going to get hit, and $1,000 of it the government's going to take. So you're going to only have $99,000 next year when you otherwise would have had $100,000. So the point is, since interest income and dividends are also taxed. Or the, you know, capital gains are typically taxed too, sometimes even at a much higher, well, they're actually usually charged at a lower rate. But the point is, the vehicle by which you transform present, potential present consumption into future consumption typically is hit also by the income tax. So that's the sense in which, and that's what economists mean when they say that an income tax does a double tax on savings, even though, you know, Rothbard doesn't like that phrase. Okay, so that's what they have in mind, and Rothbard is not challenging that. I mean, that's the beginning of this section on income taxation. Rothbard goes through two different ways in which the income tax penalizes saving and makes people save less than they otherwise would have. All right, but again, just be careful. He's not denying that an income tax penalizes saving. His point is, what's wrong with that is not because saving is good. It's wrong, it's bad, it's economically inefficient because people have their time preferences and it's making them save less than their time preferences dictate. But he doesn't like the rhetoric and some of the arguments that a lot of free market economists use when arguing for the alleged virtues of a consumption versus an income tax, because a lot of times they don't phrase it as, we don't want to bias it one way or the other, just let people's time preferences manifest themselves. No, they say, oh, we want to encourage saving. We don't want to encourage consumption. And Rothbard thinks, well, that's stupid. The whole reason you save is to consume in the future. So, okay, that's that. One last point, and then I really do have to wrap this up here, is I just lost it. What was the point? Oh, it was really good. Oh, was that he says, yeah, it's his middle bullet point here. And this is something that I haven't seen anyone else really discuss, even though it's obvious once you think it through. But Rothbard's point is, and this Forbes article I sent you guys just epitomizes what he's attacking here, that a lot of times these guys who are championing the consumption tax, they act as if it doesn't impact incomes. They say, of course it does. That if the government levies a tax on consumption, once everything adjusts, the people who are in that industry are certainly, you know, their incomes are lower. So let me just give you an example. If the government comes along and slaps a $10 per pack tax on cigarettes, that's certainly going to lower the income of tobacco farmers. It's certainly going to lower the dividends for the owners of, you know, R.J. Reynolds and whatever, all the, you know, Philip Morris and all the cigarette companies. So it would be, you know, it'd be silly to say, oh, let's get rid of the income tax because we want those tobacco farmers and we want the shareholders of the cigarette companies to be rewarded for their hard work and their saving and investment. So let's just slap a $10 tax on cigarettes, so we're just penalizing consumption and not work effort. Well, that would be silly. You could say, well, clearly that's crushing the you know, the tobacco farmer would much rather have a generic income tax rather than a really punitive consumption tax on the product that he's selling. So that's just an exaggerated example to get Rofford's point across there, that a consumption tax ends up affecting everybody's incomes as well. So it's wrong when a lot of times these free market guys act as if a consumption tax to replace an income tax all of a sudden just penalizes, you know, the socially wasteful consumption, but it rewards hard work and investment and so forth. Okay, I need to stop there because, like I said, I have to go pick up my son. I will catch up with your questions in the forum. Sorry for having to move the lecture today. Like I say, I just realized I was going to be on a plane on Wednesday, so we had to scramble at the last minute here. And I will post your quiz will be normal. You know, your quiz will become available this Friday, and I'll send out the email about all that stuff. Okay, thanks, everybody, and I'll see you next time.